an off-the-beach in the Suvla Bay evacuation at the end of the Gallipoli campaign. An aggressive commander, Maud was determined to take the offensive on the Tigris front. Across the summer and autumn of 1916, he managed to build up a formidable force in Mesopotamia. He secured two fresh infantry divisions, raising the MEF to a fighting strength of more than 160,000 men, of which over 50,000 were deployed to the Tigris front, with the remainder distributed between British positions in Basra and on the Euphrates. As Maud's army expanded, Halil's contracted. Worn down by illness, desertion, and casualties incurred in the regular exchanges of fire between Turkish and British lines, the Sixth Army suffered above all from a lack of reinforcements. Maud's intelligence reported no more than 20,000 Ottomans deployed around Kut, though in fact their numbers were far fewer, perhaps only 10,500. The British advance base on the Tigris at Sheikh Saad was a hive of activity in the autumn of 1916. New riverboats expanded freight capacity to over 700 tons per day to the Tigris riverhead. To speed supplies to the front, near Kut, the British constructed a light railway line from Sheikh Saad to the Shat El Hai, the channel connecting the Tigris at Kut to the Euphrates at Nasiriyah. Running beyond the reach of Ottoman artillery, the railway was operational in September 1916 and had reached the banks of the Shat El Hai by early 1917. To improve the transport of supplies and ammunition from railhead to front, Maud ordered hundreds of Ford vans that proved surprisingly effective even after the rains had reduced the terrain to mud. Despite these advantages, the War Committee in London remained cautious. The Chief of the Imperial General Staff, General Robertson, believed Baghdad would be very difficult to take and even harder to hold, given the length of the lines of supply and communication to the Persian Gulf. Moreover, he dismissed the capture of Baghdad as of no appreciable effect on the war. As late as September 1916, Robertson's orders to Maud ruled out an advance. Yet the MEF commander kept his war plans to himself. In November, he secured permission for offensive operations against Ottoman positions on the Shat El Hai. He refused to commit to a date for the start of operations, and even kept his plans from his own staff and commanders. As it turned out, they did not have long to wait. On 10 December, General Maud wired his superiors in India and London that his preparations were complete and the start of operations against the Shat El Hai was imminent. If surprised by the short notice, the War Committee would have been astonished by the reason for Maud's haste. The MEF commander was superstitious. Maud believed 13 was his lucky number, and had decided to launch his offensive on 13 December with the 13th Division in the vanguard. The third and final battle for the devastated town of Kut opened with British artillery on 13 December. The campaign dragged on for over 2 months along a 20-mile front. Maud's men suffered heavy casualties in frontal assaults on well-entrenched Turkish positions, while superior British artillery cut down the Ottoman ranks. Yet the Turks continued to hold their lines and counterattack with remarkable tenacity. In mid-February 1917, they repulsed a full frontal assault on the Sinaiat trenches, forcing the British back with terrible losses. The battle for Kut reached its climax on 23 February, when the British managed to secure a bridgehead across the Tigris. To distract the defenders, Maud ordered assaults on the Sinaiat trenches and near Kut itself. With Ottoman troops massed to repel the British at these 2 points, Maud managed to catch the Turks by surprise 5 miles upriver from Kut, with an advance guard securing a bridgehead at the Shumran Bend. The handful of Turkish defenders there put up a determined fight, but were soon overcome by British artillery fired from very short range. By the time the Ottoman commanders realized the danger, they were unable to send enough men to stem the flood of hostile troops crossing the pontoon bridge. As British cavalry, infantry, and artillery raced across the river, Ottoman commanders recognized their situation was untenable. At risk of encirclement and capture, Halil Pasha ordered an immediate retreat from all 20 miles of positions his forces held on the left bank of the Tigris. The success of the Ottoman retreat stemmed largely from the order with which it was carried out. The main body of Ottoman troops withdrew with their guns and as many of their supplies as they could carry. A rear guard held the route until the main body had passed, then followed behind to protect the retreating force from enemy assault. Arnold Wilson, a political officer from British India, estimated the retreating Ottoman column at no more than 6,200 men, pursued by a British force in excess of 46,000 infantry and cavalry. As the Anglo-Indian army occupied the left bank of the Tigris, Captain W. Nunn of the Royal Navy led his gunships up to Kut al-Amara, where he anchored on the night of 24 February. The following morning, he sent a party ashore. They found the place deserted and ran up the Union Jack. Though the ruined town held no more strategic value for the Mesopotamia campaign than any other bend in the river, it held great symbolic value for Maud and his men. Restoring the British flag went some way towards redeeming the failures that had led to Townsend's surrender 10 months earlier. Yet for the residents of Kut, who had endured siege and the severity of Ottoman reprisals after Townsend's surrender, every change of flag had spelled devastation. They could not have viewed the return of the British with much confidence in their future. After successfully eluding the British infantry and cavalry, the retreating Ottoman army came under attack from the Royal Navy. Hundreds of miles from the sea, Captain Nunn's squadron of 5 gunboats sped upriver to overtake Halil's 13 corps. They met the Ottoman rearguard entrenched at a hairpin bend in the Tigris. For several miles, the British gunboats faced intense artillery and machine gun fire at near point-blank range. All 5 ships suffered direct hits and heavy casualties, but still managed to get past the rearguard in pursuit of the retreating Ottoman army. Nunn's squadron caught up with the main body of Halil's forces on a stretch of river running parallel to the line of retreat. Firing with all their guns, the ships wreaked havoc among the exhausted and demoralized Turkish soldiers. An Allied pilot who flew over the area described the scene as a spectacle amazing and horrible. Dead bodies and mules, abandoned guns, wagons and stores littered the road. Many of the wagons had hoisted the white flag. Men and animals, exhausted and starving, lay prone on the ground. Few of these, if any, survived the attentions of the Arab tribesmen, hanging around like wolves on their trail. I turned home, sickened. By sunset, the British naval squadron overtook retreating Turkish river vessels and managed to capture or destroy them all, including several steamships the British had surrendered to the Ottomans earlier in the campaign. The Turkish hospital ship Basra ran up the white flag and transferred hundreds of seriously wounded Turkish prisoners, along with several Britons, to British care. At the end of the day, Nunn anchored to allow his men to tend to their own dead and wounded and patch their battered ships, miles ahead of the nearest British soldiers. In 2.5 months of fighting, General Maud had shattered Halil's defences. He had broken through hitherto impregnable Turkish lines, taken some 7,500 prisoners, and reduced the 4 Ottoman divisions on the Tigris front to under 5,000 men, while preserving his own forces at near full strength. His ships controlled the river, and his aircraft dominated the skies. Maud knew the Ottomans had insufficient forces to defend Baghdad against British occupation. However, he was still operating under orders from London that barred an advance on that city. The MEF commander could only report to London and request new orders. The commanders in London welcomed the good news from Iraq, but were divided over how best to take advantage of Maud's successes. The surrender at Kut still cast a long shadow over British aspirations in Mesopotamia, and the chief of the Imperial General Staff was risk-averse. He accepted that Maud's army could occupy Baghdad, but questioned its ability to keep the city, fearing the Ottomans would return with strong reinforcements and threaten an isolated British army with yet another siege. With no troops to spare from any front, and fearing the effect on Muslim public opinion were the British to suffer another humiliation at the hands of the Sultan Caliph's holy warriors, General Robertson was unwilling to authorize Maud to do more than establish British influence in the Baghdad Vilayet province. While he instructed Maud to press enemy in direction of Baghdad, and even to raid the city with his cavalry, if doing so proved opportune, Robertson's orders of 28 February warned against being compelled later to fall back for any reason, because of the objectionable political effect that any such retirement might produce. In the ensuing exchange of telegrams, the Commander-in-Chief in India, General Charles Munro, argued enthusiastically for a rapid occupation of Baghdad while the Turks were in disorder. It would deny the Turks a strategic concentration point to menace British interests in Basra and Persia, and would greatly increase British prestige in the Islamic East. Maud also reasoned with Robertson, outlining the advantages for the British military position in Iraq to be gained from the occupation of Baghdad. One other concern weighed on the War Committee's minds. The Russians were proposing a spring offensive in Mesopotamia, with operations against Mosul, Samarra, and Baghdad. Were the Russians to get to Baghdad first, one British official reasoned, it would nullify the Sykes-Picot agreement. The weight of these arguments drove General Robertson to revise his orders to Maud. In a telegram addressed to the MEF commander on 3 March, he conceded that the feasibility of occupying Baghdad forthwith was probably greater than he had first believed. Without actually ordering Maud into Baghdad, he agreed to leave the final decision to Maud's own judgment, but reiterated all of his old fears. In brief, our object should be to attain greatest possible result from your recent victory, and at the same time to avoid overdoing things to such an extent as to incur repetition of the old communication trouble, or, after a definite occupation of Baghdad, to be compelled to withdraw. After this pause to sort his marching orders, Maud led his army upriver towards Baghdad. On 6 March they reached Salman Pak, where Townsend had been driven into retreat at the end of 1915, unopposed. They marvelled at the ancient arch of Ctesiphon, the most visible landmark for miles around, and examined the elaborate Ottoman trench network prepared for the defence of Baghdad and subsequently abandoned. Turkish commanders had decided to concentrate their defences on the Diyala River, one of the tributaries of the Tigris downstream from Baghdad. The British were surprised by the intensity of Turkish resistance on the Diyala, which held Maud's column in check for 3 days, during which both sides suffered heavy casualties. But the Diyala position was no more than a holding operation. Halil recognised that Baghdad could not be defended against Maud's superior numbers and firepower. Inside Baghdad, Ottoman civil and military officials did their best to preserve order while preparing to evacuate the city. For Tolib Mushtaq, the Baghdad schoolboy who had chatted with British POWs from Kut, it was inconceivable that the Turks would abandon Baghdad to foreign occupation. On the eve of the evacuation, Mushtaq and his brother were called to the office of the deputy governor, an old family friend, who, with emotion and pain etched on his face, sent the two boys under police protection to rejoin their family in the nearby town of Baqaba, where their father served in the civil administration. "We are now evacuating Baghdad," the deputy governor explained, "and the Turkish army is retreating on all fronts. The English army is likely to enter Baghdad tomorrow or the day after." Mushtaq was incredulous. "How could we evacuate Baghdad?" the patriotic teenager asked. "How could we allow the hooves of English horses to defile the soil of this sacred homeland?" But the deputy governor was adamant, and the two boys were taken from school and dispatched under escort to their frantic parents in Baqaba. The illusion of normalcy was shattered shortly after midnight on 11 March, when the Ottomans and their German allies began to destroy military installations in Baghdad. German engineers severed the steel cables securing the wireless masts, which came crashing to the ground. Heavy explosions rocked the city as the derricks, cranes, and water tanks of the Baghdad Railway Company were dynamited. One by one, the main government offices were blown up, and the pontoon bridge across the Tigris was torched. Oscar Heiser, the American consul in Baghdad, watched the systematic destruction of Ottoman Baghdad from his rooftop. As the Ottoman state withdrew, disorder took its place. Looting of the market and bazaars by the Kurds and Arabs of the lower class began immediately, he noted in his consular log. By morning, The looting had reached such proportions that Consul Heiser, accompanied by an armed retainer, set off on horseback in search of the British advance guard. By 9:30 he encountered a detachment of Indian lancers, led by a British major, and accompanied them into the centre of the city. The streets were crowded with people, Heiser noted, many of whom had just before been looting, but were now looking virtuous and cheering the troops. The lancers proceeded to the main bazaars, where they found men, women, and children stripping the last of the goods from shop shelves. The looters also stripped the windows, doors, and woodwork of many houses. The major drew his revolver and fired several shots in the air, scattering the looters, who were beaten by the lancers as they fled past Baghdad's new masters. General Maud waited until the town had been secured before making a low-key entry later that afternoon. The Union Jack that enthusiastic soldiers had raised over the citadel earlier in the day was lowered, to be hoisted anew over the clock tower of the Turkish barracks following Maud's entry. However, the conqueror of Baghdad was barred from making any official statement without government approval. Back in London, the British cabinet tasked Sir Mark Sykes, Lord Kitchener's Middle East adviser and co-author of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, with drafting a formal proclamation in Maud's name. As Arnold Wilson tartly remarked, the document bears in every line the mark of Sykes's ebullient Orientalism. The proclamation opened in high rhetorical style, reassuring the people of Baghdad, "Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators. Since the days of the 13th century Mongol conqueror, Hulagu, your city and your lands have been subject to the tyranny of strangers. Your palaces have fallen into ruins, your gardens have sunk in desolation, and your forefathers and yourselves have groaned in bondage. Your sons have been carried off to wars not of your seeking. Your wealth has been stripped from you by unjust men and squandered in distant places." Printed in both English and Arabic and distributed freely in Baghdad, Maud's proclamation failed to persuade Iraqis that the British were anything other than the latest in a long line of strangers to subject their country to despotism. As Talib Mushtaq recalled, after his entry into Baghdad, General Maud announced that he had not come as a conqueror, but as a saviour and a liberator. "What shameful lies and deceit, for the people of Baghdad and of Iraq as a whole saw with their own eyes how the English treated the Iraqis as slaves or as captives. So where was the freedom? Where was the salvation?" These were small considerations to the British War Committee. After a string of catastrophic failures on the Ottoman front, the British had finally scored a major victory. Baghdad might have been of little or no strategic value to the overall war effort, but any victory was welcome, and Baghdad, city of the Arabian Nights, was an exotic prize. For the Ottomans, the fall of Baghdad was a grave reversal. The ancient capital of the Abbasid Caliphate, 750 to 1258 CE, was also the intended terminus of the Berlin to Baghdad railway and the launching pad for Ottoman post-war ambitions in the Persian Gulf. With the loss of Baghdad, coupled with their losses to the Russians in eastern Anatolia, including the garrison town of Erzurum and the Black Sea port of Trabzon, the fall of Mecca and Jeddah to the Hashemites in the Hejaz, and their recent setbacks in the Sinai, the Ottomans once again were being pressed back on all their frontiers. The British victory in Baghdad encouraged the War Cabinet to reassess its strategy in Egypt. Since taking the Sinai border town of Rafah in January 1917, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force had been under orders to defer further operations until the autumn. Yet Allied war planners were reconsidering their approach to the war as a whole. On 26 February 1917, British and French generals had met in the English Channel port of Calais to review the global strategy for the war. In a bid to regain the initiative, the Allies decided to take action against the Central Powers on several fronts simultaneously, on the Western Front, in Macedonia and in Mesopotamia, in a coordinated spring offensive. With Maud's occupation of Baghdad on 11 March, the timing was opportune for the EEF to play its part. The Allies were further encouraged when the United States joined their ranks by declaring war on Germany on 2 April 1917. It took a great deal to overturn American isolationism. After all, Woodrow Wilson successfully ran for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." However, a combination of unrestricted German U-boat attacks on Atlantic shipping, the sinking of the passenger ship SS Lusitania off the coast of Ireland on 7 May 1915, claimed 128 Americans among the 1,201 lives lost, and revelations of German overtures to conclude an alliance with Mexico in the event of American entry into the war sufficed to secure America's adhesion to the Allied cause. Though far from a military power in 1917, America's peacetime army numbered under 100,000 men, the country's mighty industrial base and large population promised to revive the Entente's fortunes on the Western Front, encouraging British war planners to fresh action in the Middle East. The EEF was ready for action. Railway construction had continued apace in the opening months of 1917, reaching Khan Yunis, 15 miles south of Gaza, by the third week of March. The water pipeline was not far behind. A large stockpile of ammunition and supplies had been assembled near the front, allowing British officers to prepare for an offensive before the end of March. The British enjoyed numerical superiority over the defenders, with 11,000 cavalry and 12,000 infantry, and an entire division of 8,000 held in reserve. The Ottoman garrison in Gaza numbered only 4,000 men, though another 15,000 Turkish frontline troops were stationed a few miles to the rear. General Murray and his officers drew up a battle plan modelled on his previous engagements in the Sinai. The Anzac Mounted Division was ordered to encircle Gaza from the north, east, and southeast, both to cut the Turkish line of retreat and to block reinforcements. The infantry took up positions for a direct assault from the south. Like the Sinai battles, the attack on Gaza would be a race against time. Unless they could take the town before sunset, the parched British forces would have to retreat miles to the railhead to replenish their water supplies. In the early morning hours of 26 March, the cavalry set out to encircle Gaza. By 10:30, the town had been surrounded by enemy troops. The infantry, however, was delayed by heavy fog, and the order to attack wasn't given until noon. British artillery opened fire, laying waste to the coastal city of 40,000. The infantry was held back by relentless sniper and machine gun fire from Turkish lines, and the difficult terrain broken up with dense hedges of cactus. Yet, while the Ottomans concentrated on the infantry assault from the south, Anzac cavalry units closed in on Gaza from the north and east. By 6:30 p.m., their defences collapsing, Ottoman forces were on the verge of surrender. To the Turks' great good fortune, a breakdown in communications meant the British commanders had no idea how close to victory their own forces were. By late afternoon, after taking heavy casualties in a number of pitched battles around Gaza, the British ordered a general retreat. They calculated that, after the unforeseen delay in the start of battle, their men would not have enough time to secure all of their objectives before nightfall, and feared their forces would be pinned down by Ottoman reinforcements advancing on Gaza. Without access to fresh water and ammunition, neither the soldiers nor their mounts would be in any condition to continue fighting a second day. Rather than risk defeat, British generals preferred to sacrifice the day's hard-earned gains to preserve their ranks. Soldiers on both sides of the battle were equally astonished when British forces suddenly abandoned their assault on Gaza and withdrew. The retreat left the British exposed to Ottoman counter-attack, and the heavy casualties suffered while withdrawing compounded the soldiers' fury at having to abandon ground won after intense fighting. For the Ottomans, the British retreat was nothing short of a miracle, and their commanders were quick to take advantage of the opportunity to recover strategic high ground. By the end of battle on 27 March, British losses exceeded Ottoman dead and wounded. The shadow of Gallipoli hung over Gaza. "So what do you say?" a Turkish journalist asked a wounded soldier after the battle. "Do you think they'll come back?" "They can't come back, Effendi," the Turkish soldier replied gravely. They saw what regiment we were. The soldier meant that the British knew his regiment had defeated them at Gallipoli, and they would not be back for more. In his reports back to London, General Murray economized on the bad news and exaggerated his gains in this first attempt on Gaza. Claiming to have advanced 15 miles, Murray reported that his forces had inflicted very heavy losses of between 6,000 and 7,000 men, when Turkish casualties were actually under 2,500. The London newspapers, hungry for good news, published Murray's figures without question. But the soldiers in the field knew better. Briscoe Moore, a lieutenant in the Auckland Mounted Rifles, picked up a message dropped by an enemy plane shortly after the battle, which set the record straight. "You beat us at communiques, but we beat you at Gaza." The British War Cabinet ultimately called Murray's bluff. General Robertson, chief of the Imperial General Staff, informed Murray that in light of Maud's recent occupation of Baghdad and Murray's own success at Gaza, he was revising his instructions for the Egyptian Expeditionary Force. Murray's immediate objective was to defeat Turkish forces south of Jerusalem, leading to the occupation of the Holy City. In his telegram to Murray, dated 2 April 1917, Robertson stressed the symbolic importance of the conquest of Jerusalem for the war-weary British public. "War Cabinet are anxious, therefore, that your operations should be pushed with all energy." In return, Robertson promised to supply all of the war material Murray needed to succeed. Judging from the cautious tone and many reservations raised in his correspondence with London, General Murray had little confidence in his ability to defeat the Ottomans in Palestine and take Jerusalem. His whole strategy in the arid landscape of southern Palestine had been based on a gradual advance in line with the railway and pipeline. Even if he got past Gaza, a task that had grown more difficult with Ottoman reinforcements following the First Battle of Gaza, he had grave concerns about the rapid extension of his supply lines and access to water for tens of thousands of men and animals. Yet his orders could not be clearer, and Murray began to prepare for a second attempt on Ottoman lines at Gaza. The Ottomans now knew where the British were concentrated to attack and made every effort to bar their route from Gaza to Beersheba. As Jamal Pasha recalled, "I decided to hold that front and prevent the English from breaking through at any cost by concentrating all the Turkish forces there." In the 3 weeks following the first attempt on Gaza, Jamal distributed his reinforcements along the Gaza-Beersheba line, where they built up a series of earthwork defences and trenches that subjected all approaches to Gaza to machine gun and artillery fire. Experience had taught the British commanders that fortune favoured the defender in trench warfare. To improve his troops' chances of breaking through Turkish lines, General Murray deployed some of the most terrible weapons in the British arsenal. He stockpiled 4,000 rounds of gas-tipped artillery for the initial bombardment of Ottoman positions. Although both sides had used poison gas extensively on the Western Front since the Second Battle of Ypres in April 1915, it had never been used against the Ottomans. British soldiers were issued with gas masks in advance of the attack. Ottoman soldiers, of course, had none. 8 tanks were delivered in secret to the Sinai front to assist the infantry in their advances on well-entrenched Turkish lines. "We had heard much about these monstrous engines of war," an Australian in the Camel Corps recorded, "and were overjoyed at their arrival, believing that as soon as they went into action, they would strike terror in the ranks of the enemy." The Second Battle of Gaza opened with a heavy bombardment on 17 April 1917. The gas shells fired were concentrated on one section of trenches, but proved ineffectual. Offshore, battleships subjected Gaza to a rain of steel and fire without dislodging the defenders. When finally the British soldiers advanced on Turkish lines, they faced relentless machine gun and artillery fire. Frank Reed, an Australian soldier in the Imperial Camel Corps, dismounted to go into battle under very heavy rifle and machine gun fire. Reed watched his comrades fall around him as artillery shells burst overhead. Suddenly, he heard men to his left cheering and saw one of the 8 British tanks making for the Turkish trenches. He fully expected, that once the tank reached the trenches in front, the Turks would surrender. Instead, the Ottoman soldiers took aim and fired on the tank with everything they had. Huge slugs clanged against the iron plates of the tank and ricocheted in every direction, but the tank still went on. Following in the tank's wake, the Cameliers reached the first line of Turkish trenches, where they confronted a handful of Ottoman soldiers too wounded to retreat. Reed remembered the face-to-face encounters between Australians and Turks as a moment of conflict between contradictory instincts. Two Cameliers came on a wounded Turkish soldier, his arms crossed over his chest.
"Bayonet the cow!" yelled the first Camelier.
"No, give the poor devil a chance!" cried the second.
Reed watched another Camelier snatch the rifle from a wounded Turk and pause. Rather than kill the bleeding man, the Australian bent down and gave him a drink of water.
"Poor wretch! Wants to live like the rest of us."
He then took out his own first-aid kit to dress the Turk's head wound. The compassion of the gesture was somewhat diminished when a wounded Turkish officer hobbled over to thank the Australian.
"Good," said the Turkish officer in broken English, patting the Australian on the shoulder.
"Good be damned!" cried the Camelier. "Go and bury yourself. I'm busy."
Reed continued to follow the tank's progress. Its crew seemed disoriented and began to drive erratically. Hit by several enemy shells, the tank suddenly exploded in flames. The Australian Cameliers and English infantrymen following the tank found themselves exposed to intense fire from the Turkish trenches, the dead and wounded falling on all sides. They managed to rush the Ottoman redoubt, but were soon pinned down by a Turkish counter-attack. The Cameliers, along with the English infantry and the Australian light horse, were all driven back. Over 3 days of battle, the Ottomans held their lines and drove the British into retreat with heavy losses. None of the British secret weapons had daunted the Turks, who had not noticed the gas and managed to destroy 3 of the 8 British tanks. The Turkish journalist Fale Rifki wrote lyrically about the carcasses of the dead combat tanks that littered the Gaza battlefield with their enormous mass twisted and empty. When the British generals took stock of their casualties, they were forced to break off the engagement and accept a second defeat yet more terrible than the first. By nightfall on 19 April, the British had lost 6,444 casualties, 3 times Ottoman losses of 2,013 dead, wounded, and missing. The Palestine campaign had, for the moment, stalled. Murray's failures at Gaza cost him his job. He was replaced in July 1917 by General Sir Edmund Allenby, dispatched by Prime Minister David Lloyd George, with the seemingly impossible assignment of conquering Jerusalem by Christmas. Jamal Pasha was in a far stronger position. His forces held the well-watered lands of Palestine and had confined the British to the Sinai Desert. Moreover, the Ottomans had prevented the British from making contact with the forces of the Arab revolt. So long as the EEF and the Arab army were kept apart, the Ottomans stood every chance of preserving their position in Syria and Palestine. As the Ottomans held the Egyptian expeditionary force in check, they faced renewed threats from the Arab army in the Hejaz. With Ottoman forces confined to Medina, the Hashemites were free to extend their control over the rest of the Hejaz and advance northward towards Syria. As commander of the Arab army, Sharif Hussein's son Faisal's sights were set on the Red Sea port of Wej. His British advisers were in full agreement. The supply line from Suez to Wej was 200 miles shorter than that to Yanbu, and from Wej the Arab army would be in position to attack a 250-mile stretch of the Hejaz railway. Cutting the railway line would sever the supply line and communications to Ottoman forces besieged in Medina, hastening their surrender. For Faisal, the march on Wej was a recruitment opportunity. He needed to broaden tribal participation in the revolt to prevent it from collapsing. By riding northward at the head of an 11,000-strong army, Faisal knew he would make a great impression on local Bedouin and attract the allegiance of fresh tribes. He also hoped to overwhelm the 800 Turkish defenders at Wej with the sheer mass of his army, and secure their surrender without a fight. The Royal Navy coordinated closely with the Arab army.
To ensure the Bedouin force had sufficient water supplies, the HMS Harding deposited 20 tons of water in tanks at an agreed-on location just south of Wej. The ship also carried an advanced troop of 400 tribesmen to land due north of Wej. With Faisal's forces arriving from the south, this advanced troop could prevent any Ottoman effort to reinforce or retreat from Wej. Faisal and the British agreed to meet at Wej at dawn on 23 January 1917. The small Bedouin force disembarked to the north of Wej, with a landing party of 200 British marines and sailors from the Harding right on schedule. They found no sign of Faisal or his army. Undeterred, some 100 tribesmen approached the town to engage the Turkish defenders. As most of the garrison had already withdrawn to an old fort some 6 miles inland, the attackers quickly broke through the Turkish lines to plunder the town before the rest of the Arab army arrived. The last of the defenders took refuge in Wej's mosque, where they held out until the building was struck by naval gunfire. The British ships then trained their guns on the old fort, driving the Ottoman soldiers into headlong retreat. By the time Faisal arrived on 25 January, 2 days after the scheduled start of hostilities, Wej was securely in Arab hands. The show of strength had paid off, as tribal leaders from all around northern Hejaz now called on Faisal to offer their allegiance to the Hashemite cause. Once established in Wej, Faisal and his British advisers went to work on disrupting the Hejaz railway. On 20 February, the first raiding party succeeded in detonating a charge under an Ottoman train, destroying the locomotive. The attack had an immediate impact on morale in both Damascus and Medina. Jamal Pasha sent orders to the Ottoman commander in Medina, Fahri Pasha, to evacuate the city. The British, who intercepted Jamal's orders, instructed their officers in the Hejaz to redouble their attacks on the railway line to prevent an Ottoman withdrawal. So long as it was confined to Medina, Fahri's 11,000-man garrison posed no threat to Arab or British forces elsewhere. Given that Murray's Egyptian expeditionary force was preparing to make its first attack on Gaza, the British sought at all costs to prevent Jamal from using the Medina garrison to reinforce his positions in Palestine. Throughout the month of March, British sappers and their Arab guides placed mines at strategic points along the Hejaz railway. At the end of March, even T.E. Lawrence, who served as liaison between British commanders in Cairo and Faisal, tried his hand at blowing up an isolated station. Armed with a mountain gun, machine guns and explosives, Lawrence and his team managed to disrupt traffic on the railway line for 3 days with the mayhem they unleashed. The attacks on the railway, combined with Fahri Pasha's determination to defend the Holy City, prevented the evacuation of Medina. Yet they failed to obstruct communications and supply along the Damascus to Medina railway. The Ottomans proved remarkably resourceful, discovering mines before they detonated, and repairing the damage of successful charges with great efficiency. It was clear that the war in the Hejaz would not be won on the railway alone. While British officers perfected their rail-blasting techniques, Faisal set about organizing a regular army to bring discipline to the Arab forces. He recruited Jafar el-Askari, an Ottoman officer captured by the British in the Senussi campaign in Egypt, in Faisal's words, to create a regular army capable of carrying out its military duties in an appropriate fashion. Askari was reunited with a number of fellow Iraqis, many of them members of Al-Ahed, the secret Arabist society favoured by military men. They became some of Faisal's most devoted followers, ideologically committed to the cause of Arab independence. British arms and supplies began to flood the growing Sharifian headquarters at Wej. A shipment of 30,000 rifles and 15 million rounds of ammunition reached the Red Sea port. Armoured cars, manufactured by Rolls-Royce, were unloaded and began to patrol the desert flats, providing mobile firepower. The Royal Flying Corps created a series of landing strips to permit its planes to bomb the Hejaz railway. Gold and grain were unloaded in great quantities to pay and feed the growing numbers in the Arab army. With such reinforcements, Faisal began to consider extending his lines beyond the Hejaz into the southern reaches of Syria. To prepare the ground for a bold move further north, Faisal dispatched three of his most trusted lieutenants on a reconnaissance journey. Sharif Nasser ibn Ali, a notable of Medina and close confidant of Faisal's, Auda Abu Tai, leader of the powerful Huwaitot tribe, and Nasib el-Bakri, whose family introduced Faisal to the Arabist movement in Damascus. The three departed on 19 May for the Wadi Sihan, the valley that for centuries had served as the main caravan route between Central Arabia and the Syrian desert. Each had a distinct mission. Sharif Nasser was sent as Faisal's personal representative to gain the loyalty of the Syrian tribes. Auda was to make contact with fellow tribesmen of the Huwaitot to secure camels and sheep to transport and feed the Arab army in its forthcoming operations in southern Syria. And Bakri was to make contact with Arabists in and around Damascus to gain their support for a general uprising. T. E. Lawrence asked to accompany the small expedition. 3 days before they set off, Lawrence had met with Sir Mark Sykes, who had travelled to the Hijaz to brief the Hashemites on the terms of the Sykes-Pico agreement. If, as seems likely, Sykes took the opportunity to brief Lawrence as well, the idealistic young English officer would have been appalled by the British government's double-dealing. Lawrence's actions and writings make clear that he was determined to assist the Arabs in securing Syria before the French could. Sharif Nasser's expedition gave him the opportunity to act on his convictions. After a taxing journey across the desert, Sharif Nasser's expedition reached the Wadi Sirhan. After 3 days with the Huwaitot, the members of the group set off on their different tasks. Nasib el-Bakri went to Damascus to work with Arabists there. Lawrence reconnoitred the terrain surrounding Damascus to drum up support for the revolt, managing to blow up a railway bridge between Beirut and Damascus for good measure. Sharif Nasser and Auda Abu Tai actively recruited tribesmen to join their movement. On 18 June, Nasser, Auda, and Lawrence reassembled at the mouth of the Wadi Sirhan. Bakri had chosen to remain in Damascus. Through the combined efforts of Auda and Nasser, some 560 Huwaitot tribesmen had joined their force. Their numbers were not sufficient to attack a major Ottoman garrison, such as the railway depot at Ma'an, in modern Jordan. Instead, at the end of June, the small column advanced towards the Red Sea port of Aqaba. The port of Aqaba sits at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, the eastern fork of the Red Sea that divides Sinai from the Hijaz. This backwater had immense strategic value. Its capture would give British forces in Egypt and the Sinai direct lines of communication with the Arab army. The conquest of Aqaba would place all of the Hijaz, except Medina, under Hashemite control, and the Sharif's army would control the southern entrance to the Syrian lands. Since the opening days of the war, when the British bombarded Aqaba with impunity, the Ottomans had built strong sea defences to protect the little port. However, they had never anticipated an attack from the landward side. The mounted column led by Sharif Nasser sought to exploit this weakness. Bypassing the garrison at Ma'an, the 600 Bedouin fighters crossed the Hijaz railway further south, at the Ghada el-Hajj station, which they sacked. Lawrence did as much damage to the railway line as possible to slow the movement of Ottoman reinforcements from Ma'an. He claimed to have ruined 10 bridges and many rails before running out of explosives. On 2 July, Sharif Nasser's column surrounded a Turkish battalion sent to guard the approaches to Aqaba at a spot called Abu el-Lisen. After subjecting the Ottoman soldiers to hours of sniping, Auda led his tribesmen in a headlong rush. The Ottoman soldiers froze in horror at the sight of the galloping horsemen and took flight. By Lawrence's account, 300 Turkish soldiers were left dead or dying, with only 160 survivors taken prisoner. Only 2 tribesmen were killed. The success of Arab arms against the Ottomans encouraged more tribesmen to join the Hashemite movement, and the small column grew larger. The Arab army enlisted a Turkish prisoner to draft letters to the commanders of the 3 isolated army outposts between Abu el-Lisen and Aqaba. The letters promised good treatment to those who surrendered and no mercy for those who resisted. The first outpost surrendered without a fight. The second outpost resisted and was taken without the Arabs suffering a single casualty. The third Turkish unit negotiated, then resisted, before finally capitulating when it found itself surrounded and fired on from all sides. The last barrier broken, Sharif Nasser's small army raced through a driving sandstorm down to Aqaba, 4 miles further, and splashed into the sea on July the 6th, Lawrence exulted, just 2 months after our setting out from Wej. Victory at Aqaba was the Arab revolt's greatest achievement to date. Sharif Nasser wrote a report to Faisal that same day, crediting the tribesmen for their courageous action. Lawrence, recognizing the significance for British war planners, set off across the Sinai for Cairo, accompanied by 8 volunteers. Still dressed in Bedouin robes and headdress, Lawrence seemed to revel in the shock he caused at British headquarters in Cairo on 10 July, when, mistaken for a ragged Arab, he spoke with a perfect Oxford accent. At that moment, Captain Lawrence was transformed into the celebrated Lawrence of Arabia. However much the top brass frowned at his appearance, his news of an Arab victory in Aqaba made him an overnight hero. Sir Reginald Wingate, the High Commissioner in Cairo, dashed a telegraph off to the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, Sir William Robertson, that same night. His claims suggest that either Lawrence or Wingate himself had inflated Arab gains. Captain Lawrence arrived Cairo today by land from Aqaba, Turkish posts between Tafila, Ma'an, and Aqaba in Arab hands. For the new commander of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, General Sir Edmund Allenby, the Arab victory at Aqaba had the potential to transform the British position in Sinai. He invited Lawrence to brief him on 12 July. After relating the events of the occupation of Aqaba, Lawrence, still dressed in Bedouin robes, expanded on his ideas for a general Arab uprising against Ottoman forces from Ma'an in the south as far as Hama in modern Syria to the north, severing Turkish rail communications with Medina, Damascus, and Palestine. To support the Arab effort, Lawrence asked Allenby to invade Palestine and pin down Jamal Pasha's forces. Allenby was noncommittal. "Well," he said to close the interview, "I will do for you what I can." In fact, Allenby was captivated by what Lawrence and the Arab revolt might do for the EEF. He wrote to the War Committee the following week to endorse Lawrence's call for cooperation between the Arab army and the Palestine campaign. Such a two-front assault, he argued, could cause a collapse of the Turkish campaign in the Hejaz and in Syria, and produce far-reaching results, both political as well as military. Of course, in order for Allenby to fulfill his part of the plan, he would need reinforcements. He asked for, and received, 2 fresh divisions for the EEF. Finally, to ensure seamless communications between the two forces, Allenby proposed bringing Faisal and his army under his own command. Lawrence was dispatched to Wej and Jeddah to secure the acquiescence of Faisal and Sharif Hussein to placing the Arab revolt under British command. As of August 1917, General Allenby was securely in command of a 2-front campaign to defeat the Ottomans in Syria and Palestine. He turned his attention towards the Palestine front and prepared his army for a 3rd attempt on Gaza. Following the surrender of Aqaba, the Ottomans tried to beat the Arab army at their own game. They actively courted the loyalty of the leading tribes of Transjordan, as the British termed the southern extremities of Ottoman Syria to the east of the Jordan River, and recruited armed militias from the local population to reinforce their overextended regular army units. By rallying the Arabs of Transjordan against Faisal's army, the Ottomans hoped to force the Hashemites to fight on hostile territory. Ottoman efforts to recruit local militias met with mixed results. In the northern districts of Transjordan, where all young men had already been conscripted into the Ottoman army, only the elderly were left to serve in the volunteer force. The Ottoman officer dispatched to Irbid to inspect the Mujahideen, jihad fighters, was appalled to find a corps of elderly gentlemen, most of whom were infirm by age and degree. The military authorities ordered the Irbid volunteer force disbanded, and for its members to pay a military exemption tax instead. In the town of Amman, capital of the modern Kingdom of Jordan, the Circassian community responded enthusiastically to the Ottoman call to arms. The Circassians came to Transjordan in the late 19th century as refugees, fleeing Russian conquests in the Caucasus. As a refugee settler community, they were actually exempted from military service. However, the Circassians were the ultimate Ottoman loyalists, and in November 1916, the head of their community, Mirza Wasfi, petitioned Istanbul for permission to form a volunteer cavalry unit to offer their lives in sacrifice to the homeland. The Circassian volunteer cavalry numbered over 150 mounted fighters and played an active role in defending the Hejaz railway and combating the forces of the Arab revolt. A third volunteer force was formed in the southern town of Karak, seat of an Ottoman deputy governor. The hilltop town, built into a Crusader-era citadel overlooking the Dead Sea, had been the center of a major tribal revolt in 1910 that the Ottomans had put down with great violence. The townspeople of Karak did not love the Ottomans, but they certainly feared them and displayed unqualified loyalty throughout the First World War. After the outbreak of the Arab revolt, Jamal Pasha went to Karak in person to remind the townspeople of each Ottoman subject's duty to protect the state, and asked them to form a militia for the defense of their territory. The different tribes and clans, Muslims and Christians alike, volunteered for the militia under the command of an Ottoman colonel. The Ottomans also cultivated the loyalty of Bedouin tribes along the Transjordan frontier. Jamal Pasha invited leading tribal sheikhs to visit Damascus by train at government expense, where they were housed in hotels and treated to lavish hospitality. Commending them for their display of friendship and service to the government, Jamal showered the tribesmen with medals and honors. In this way, members of the Ruwala, Bili, Bani, Atiya, and Hawitort tribes were all courted with some success. While key tribal leaders like Auda Abu Tayyi, awarded an Osmani medal, fourth class, threw in their lot with the Hashemites, others remained loyal to the Ottoman cause. Indeed, even Auda wavered in his loyalty. T.E. Lawrence confronted the Hawitort warrior with evidence of his correspondence with Jamal Pasha offering to swap sides. In the competition for Bedouin loyalties, the Ottomans were not to be underestimated. The Ottomans put Arab loyalties to the test immediately after the fall of Aqaba in July 1917. Fearful lest the Hashemites' shock victory turn the Arabs of Transjordan against the Ottoman state, Jamal Pasha ordered the tribal militias to mount an attack on Faisal's army in Aqaba. He promised the Bedouin volunteers all the support the Ottoman army could muster, regular infantry and cavalry, artillery and aircraft. The Ottomans gave each commander 5 days' food for their men and fodder for their horses. Each horseman was paid 3 Turkish pounds in gold, and their commanders received 5 gold pounds. The tribesmen responded enthusiastically and set off from Karak to assemble in the garrison town of Ma'an in mid-July. Oda El-Gasus was a notable from Karak with a distinguished record in the Ottoman civil service. Fluent in Turkish, he often served as a translator between government officials and local townsmen. The Sharif of Mecca held no particular appeal to Gasus, a Christian, and he noted Sharif Hussein's overtures to the people of Transjordan with detachment. He played a leading role organizing the Karak militia. Along with more than 400 Muslim volunteers, Gasus mobilized 80 Christians to serve in the Karaki battalion and served as their commander as they set off for battle on 17 July 1917. Gasus watched as the tribesmen in the campaign faltered in their enthusiasm. He knew the men of the Hawitort and Bani Sakha tribes and understood their hesitation to fight. Rival branches of both tribes, including Auda Abu Tayyi of the Hawitort, had sided with Faisal. Were they to kill members of their own tribes in battle, the blood feuds could last for generations. Gasus also noted that the tribal militias were heading into battle with none of the support Jamal Pasha had promised them. There were no regular forces or artillery, let alone aircraft, to back them up. Jamal was trying to provoke enmity between the tribes of Transjordan and the tribes supporting the Hashemite revolt without risking any of his limited troops and resources in Ma'an. The Karak militia attacked a detachment of the Arab army at El Kuwera, a small telegraph station 25 miles northeast of Aqaba. The Huwitot and Bani Sakha Bedouin watched the engagement from the surrounding hilltops without engaging in the battle themselves. The action lasted 3 hours, and the Karakis claimed victory after killing 9 of the Arabs and driving the rest into retreat. The Karakis seized over 1,000 head of sheep and 30 donkeys, a few camels and 10 tents, and returned to Ma'an triumphant. In keeping with tribal raiding practice, they treated the captured livestock as booty. They left 500 sheep as a gift to the Ottoman army and drove the rest of the herd home to Karak as their own reward for the successful raid. The attack was trivial. Faisal's forces reoccupied El Kuwera shortly after, but the Ottomans had succeeded in driving a wedge between the local population and the Hashemite army that would persist to the end of the war. The Ottoman Minister of War, Enver Pasha, convened his army commanders in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo on 24 June 1917. Halil Pasha, commander of the 6th Army in Mesopotamia, Mustafa Kemal Pasha, the hero of Gallipoli, Izzet Pasha, commander of the Caucasus Army, and Jamal Pasha, governor of Syria and commander of the 4th Army, were all in attendance for this extraordinary meeting. As Jamal noted in his memoirs, the meeting of 4 army commanders with the chief of the general staff to preside was not an everyday affair. Enver proposed a bold new initiative to the Turkish top brass. "I am contemplating an offensive with the view to the recovery of Baghdad," Enver explained. Towards this end, he proposed the creation of a new Ottoman formation under German command to be called the Yıldırım Group. Yıldırım, the word means lightning or blitz in Turkish, was to be organized along the lines of a German army group. It would combine Halil Pasha's 6th Army and a new 7th Army under Mustafa Kemal's command, with a full German infantry division. The commander-in-chief would be General Erich von Falkenhayn, whose recent successes in Romania had gone some way to redeeming his reputation after his failure to break through French lines at Verdun in 1916. The German government committed £5 million in gold, extremely scarce resources in mid-1917, to ensure Yıldırım had the resources to succeed. The Ottoman army commanders were stunned by Enver's plan. Offensive operations to recover Baghdad seemed foolhardy when the empire was threatened by attack on so many other crucial fronts, and they were appalled by the prospect of coming under German command. The Yıldırım staff was overwhelmingly German, comprising 65 foreign officers and only 9 Turks. Relations between Germans and Turks had grown strained in the course of the war. Soldiers' diaries capture the resentment among officers and the ranks alike at what they saw as German arrogance. Mustafa Kemal warned Enver that Turkey was becoming a German colony. Even Otto Liemann von Sanders, head of the German military mission to the Ottoman Empire, thought it a mistake to dispatch officers from Germany who had no knowledge of the Ottoman Empire or Turkish culture. Reliance on interpreters to make their commands understood caused much goodwill between Germans and Turks to be lost in translation. Despite the opposition of all of his army commanders, Enver was not to be deterred. Over the summer months of 1917, the Yıldırım Group began to assemble in Aleppo for eventual deployment in Mesopotamia. Jamal continued to submit intelligence reports, tracking the growing British force along the Gaza-Beersheba front, and to lobby for a change in policy. For his pains, Jamal was relieved of his command over the Palestine front, which passed to von Falkenhayn. The German general, however, was not deaf to Jamal's concerns. By the end of September, von Falkenhayn was convinced of the British threat to Palestine and persuaded Enver to divert the Yıldırım Group to address the danger. On 30 September, the Yıldırım Group began to move south to the Palestine front. As the German and Turkish divisions of Yıldırım converged on Aleppo, the first of Allenby's own reinforcements began to arrive in Egypt. The politicians wanted Allenby to deliver Jerusalem as a Christmas present to the war-weary British public. The generals wanted him to achieve as much as he could with the forces at his disposal, making it very clear that he was unlikely to secure any more support. His orders were similar to those given General Maud before his advance on Baghdad, to break through Turkish lines and pursue the Turks as far as his resources permitted, but to avoid getting overextended at all costs. There was to be no defeat, retreat, or Kut-style surrender. The Egyptian Expeditionary Force now enjoyed a comfortable margin of superiority over Ottoman defenders around Gaza. The British had mobilized twice the estimated 40,000 Ottoman infantry and eight times the 1,500 mounted troops, and had a 3-2 preponderance in artillery over the Turks. Yet it was not enough to simply outnumber the defenders. The British had lost the first two battles for Gaza in frontal assaults on tenaciously defended trenches. Over the intervening months, the Turks had worked tirelessly to improve their defenses. To overcome well-entrenched defensive lines, Allenby had to rely on deception. The third battle of Gaza was a complex plan involving feints and ruses. British intelligence had confirmed that Ottoman defenses were strongest around Gaza and weakest at Beersheba, where the defenders counted on the inhospitable terrain to deter an offensive. Allenby decided to strike there, for if he could take Beersheba, he could assure his troops of a reliable water supply and outflank Ottoman positions surrounding Gaza. Allenby's plans called for preliminary attacks to concentrate Ottoman forces in Gaza and leave Beersheba vulnerable to a surprise attack. The British went to great lengths to mislead Ottoman commanders. The head of military intelligence, Colonel Richard Meinertzhagen, rode towards Turkish lines until Ottoman cavalry intercepted him. He provoked the enemy horsemen into a gunfight and chase, in which he dropped a blood-smeared satchel with fake documents setting out British plans for an attack on Gaza. British intelligence also spread false rumours of a naval landing to the north of Gaza. The presence of British warships off the coast only lent credence to these rumours. Allenby issued his orders on 22 October, 10 days before the start of operations. His plans called for moving infantry and cavalry units gradually into positions opposite Beersheba to avoid alerting the defenders to a troop build-up that could only mean a major assault. By 30 October, the attackers were in place. They struck at dawn the following morning, announcing their attack with a heavy artillery bombardment on Ottoman lines in Beersheba. Emin Çöl, a veteran of the Gallipoli campaign, was one of the soldiers in the Turkish trenches at Beersheba. "We woke to the sound of artillery," he recalled. "We had not slept anyway." Turkish lines in Beersheba were in a deplorable state. Their narrow trenches were too shallow to provide much protection. Each 50-meter line lay totally isolated from other Ottoman positions. There were no communication trenches to permit the safe transit of men and materiel to and from the front. Without adequate shelter from enemy artillery, Ottoman casualties instantly mounted, the dead and wounded clogging the trenches without the living having any safe means to move them. Little wonder that Çöl had no stomach for the impending battle. "What kind of war are we fighting?" he mused. "The Ottoman army has no working artillery, no functioning machine guns, no aircraft, no commanding officers, no defensive lines, no reserves, no telephone. The troops are fighting in total isolation of each other, and their morale has collapsed. Indeed, this army has none of the things it would need to win." However demoralized they might have been, the Ottoman soldiers put up a stiff defense. Marching into heavy Turkish gunfire, the British infantry managed to reach their designated positions by early afternoon, but, facing sustained resistance, went no further. The British infantry dug into positions in the hills overlooking Beersheba from the south to await further orders. The success of the attack hinged on the cavalry. Riding 25 miles overnight, the Desert Mounted Corps was tasked with circling around Beersheba to enter the town from the northeast. Once again, the horsemen faced a water constraint. Unless they took Beersheba and its wells by sunset, men and horses would not have enough water to fight a second day. In the course of the morning, Anzac cavalry units came under heavy machine gun fire from Ottoman defenders, that slowed their progress and put the whole operation at risk. By mid-afternoon, the horsemen's chances of securing the town by sunset looked slim. General Sir Harry Chauvel, commander of the Desert Mounted Corps, decided to break with the agreed-on plan and risk a direct cavalry assault on the Turkish trenches guarding the entry to the town. With only half an hour before the autumn sun set, the 4th Australian Light Horse Brigade got into position. Some 800 horsemen in two broad columns, spread 400 yards apart, set off towards Turkish lines at a trot. It was the largest cavalry charge of the Great War, probably the greatest such attack in a century. The celebrated 1854 charge of the Light Brigade in the Crimean War, by comparison, numbered under 700 troopers. As they came within range of Turkish guns, the cavalry accelerated to a canter and then a full gallop. The defenders had great difficulty in taking aim against such fast-moving targets. Emin Churl watched as the thundering cavalry approached his lines. The hundreds of horsemen swept over the first line of trenches, forcing Churl and his comrades to take cover to avoid being crushed under the horses' hooves. Groups of cavalrymen dismounted to engage the defenders in hand-to-hand fighting. Churl continued to fire on the British for as long as he could see them. Suddenly, though still conscious, Churl lost his vision. He had been wounded and could feel blood flowing down his face. In the heat of battle, his friends bandaged his wounds and took him to a sheltered spot before surrendering. They told me that two British soldiers were approaching us. They took my hand and made me come out of the trench. Now prisoner, Churl would regain his liberty in a year, but he never regained his sight. The cavalry continued their race into Beersheba, fearful that the now retreating Ottomans would destroy the wells as they withdrew. The town was rocked by a series of heavy explosions, as an ammunition dump was destroyed and rolling stock in the railway station dynamited, to prevent them from falling into English hands. The horsemen saw two wells blown before they could intervene to protect the rest. With darkness falling, British forces descended on Beersheba from all sides as the Ottomans attempted to withdraw. By midnight, the town was securely in British hands as surviving Ottoman forces completed their withdrawal under cover of night. The commanders of the Yildirim group were stunned by the sudden loss of Beersheba in a single day's fighting. Those soldiers who managed to elude capture fell back on Gaza, whose defences had twice withstood invasion. Yet Gaza was no safe haven. The British subjected the town to the heaviest bombardment witnessed anywhere outside the European theatres of war. Between 27 and 31 October, ground-based artillery and naval gunfire combined to deliver over 15,000 rounds into Ottoman positions in and around Gaza. The reinforcements who took up positions in Gaza entered a living hell. British infantry attacked Ottoman positions facing Gaza on 1 and 2 November. These were feints designed to convince the defenders that the British intended a direct assault. To further confuse the situation, British cavalry held manoeuvres between Beersheba and the hill town of Hebron further north, raising Ottoman fears of a direct attack on Jerusalem. The Yildirim commanders responded by dispatching troops to defend Gaza and Hebron, leaving central positions in their 20-mile front between Gaza and Beersheba thinly defended. This had been Allenby's ultimate object, to force the Turks to deplete their central positions and to drive the main body of his force through the gap. The Third Battle of Gaza entered its final act on 6 November, when Allenby unleashed the main body of his force on Turkish positions halfway between Gaza and Beersheba. In a day of intense fighting, British forces succeeded in breaching Turkish lines at several key points along a 7-mile front and penetrated 9 miles inside Ottoman territory. Yet the British were amazed by the tenacity of the Turkish defence. Australian soldiers of the Imperial Camel Corps were pinned down for 2 days by Ottoman forces at Tel el Huelfa, due north of Beersheba. Fighting alongside the Welsh infantry, the Cameliers suffered their worst losses of the Palestine campaign. Frank Reed listed the names of his comrades cut down beside him during the days of bloody fighting. Sergeant Dan Pollard, shot through the head. Sergeant Arthur Oxford, shot in the nose. Frank Matsonis, who had only just emigrated from Riga to Australia in 1914, shot in the brain. Reg Reed, who got lost and was bayoneted in a Turkish trench. The list went on and on. Another cameleer named Nielsen lay wounded in the open for several hours, close to the Turkish trenches. Each time he called out, the Turks put a bullet